Hey there, foreigners. This is Rohit from BreakingTheBorders.com, home of the ambitious immigrants. Our today's guest is an entrepreneur who faced a lot of immigration challenges. Instead of quitting, he decided to do something very different. He decided to solve them and turn it into a business. He is Nitin Pachisia. He is the founder of Unshackled.co, which is a fund designed to extend the entrepreneurship opportunities to immigrants on all work visas, H1, F1, whatnot. He's going to tell us how he got here and how his firm helps immigrants. Nitin, welcome to Breaking the Borders podcast.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. So, Nitin, tell us what it was like before you came to the US. What was life like before you came into the entrepreneurial world?
Well, the entrepreneurial world started about 7 years after I was in the US, but grew up as a typical boy in India, typical school routines with cricket on two sides of that. So no surprises there. But I grew up in Delhi all the way through my undergrad, and then decided I want a job which takes me on some travels. So waited about 4 months to select the job, which kind of fit that description, with ABB, joined them as part of their Asia Pacific internal audit group. That lasted about 3 years before I was tired of traveling. And then Deloitte approached me to help start or integrate their India practice with the US practice. That was based out of Hyderabad, but about 2 weeks later, I was here in Silicon Valley trying to understand how the US practice works so I can take those learnings back to the India practice. And that was kind of the start of the migration to US.
So I heard you in your other interview that it was against your wishes to come to the US. Is that right?
Maybe a little bit. I won't say it was against my wishes. It's just that the US visa process was the only process where I had to actually go to the embassy to get a visa. And that is not an experience I was expecting.
Oh, I see.
All other visas, you more or less your agents take care of it. And obviously, until you are here, you don't know what it's like, and there's a lot of what I would say noise around how immigrants live and operate in the U.S. There was some personal bias, but I won't say it was against the wishes. Once you land here, you all those biases are gone. Here I was not wanting to travel, but then traveling 2 weeks later, spending 3 months at a time in the US with Deloitte, and then the practice in Silicon Valley just wanted me here permanently. So starting about, I want to say October 2005, I was more or less here in Silicon Valley. Did that for about 5 years with Deloitte. Started a small practice with a partner focusing on startups and mid-sized companies, which was much more interesting than working at big companies, which were big tech companies, which were my early clients.
So what were you doing for them at Deloitte?
What's that?
What were you doing for the startups being in Deloitte?
It was mostly strategy consulting. So I did a lot of finance transformation work, operational consulting. I kind of put it across as I was helping CEOs and CFOs not get in trouble or stay out of trouble when it was at startup clients. The big companies, it was more or less a process orientation where you're trying to improve the supply chain process or the commissions process, or it's very specific, right?
Yeah.
The big companies are very siloed.
I see.
So that experience at Deloitte exposed me a lot to the startup culture, and led me to meet the CEO who I would now work for, the CEO of Chegg, also an immigrant from Pakistan. And when he started his second company, approached me if I would come and run finance, legal, HR, basically all of the business side of work for this company called KNO. It's a digital education company. I joined them very early when they were a Series Seed company. We raised a lot of money. We spent a lot of money and ended up pivoting a few times in that early.
How was it like, actually? Let me ask you before you go forward. You're working in a large company like Deloitte. Going from there to working in a startup like KNO would have been a drastic difference, right? What was the transition like for you?
It was less than what I thought it would be. And the big reason for that was at Deloitte, I was mostly working with startups, which helped me stay oriented to the startup culture. Our team at Deloitte was small, and I personally always worked in the fast lane, right? I never was able to get used to the big company lifestyle of cushion around everything. So it wasn't that big of a culture change. But what was really interesting, which I anticipated and the reason I took the job, was there was much more ownership. Is when you're a consultant, you are doing things for somebody else, suggesting things which you don't have now control over when it comes to implementation. So you make a suggestion and you get out of there and you are kind of successful in your own sense, but you don't know if those suggestions ever take shape. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my consulting kind of personal passion was to make suggestions which I could see take shape in my presence. They were much more practical. But once you are at a company in a line function, you are yourself responsible to not just come up with solutions, but also execute them.
Yeah.
Right. And that was fundamentally the big difference. The other parts of it was when you join a startup as early as the company I did, where I was, I think the 25th employee, you are, and most of the employees before me were engineers or product people. And so, you know, you're engaging with this company very early on. You got to think about how you're going to scale your team as this company starts scaling. You really have to believe in the vision, because a big part of my job was raising money. And to do that, you got to be able to tell the story with the same passion as the founders. There is a little bit more work, I would say, than at a consulting company. But
absolutely.
People who are people like me are workaholics, and I think that's not just me. That's in general. I think immigrants are extremely passionate about proving a point. They're extremely passionate about doing something above and beyond the routine asks. And that's what helps us kind of leave the competition behind. I often use this analogy. There are 7 billion people outside the US, of which 1.3 million are highly skilled immigrants who have made it to the US, who are on visas. So think of that pre-filtration that happens before this talent gets here. And a big component of that is not just that you're smart, but much more that you're willing to take certain risks. You're willing to be uncomfortable. It's not, you know, it's not as easy as when I was in India. I was making pretty good moolah. I mean, you know, I was one of the better paid people, and leave all that, come to a place where it's all a do it yourself economy. Everything you do, you're doing yourself. And on top of that, you're in a completely new place, building new relationships, trying to set up your whole ecosystem, support system. So
it's more than just, you know, being smart and trying to figure out things. It's about, you know, taking risk and getting outside your comfort zone and all the other non-technical aspects of the personality, right?
Absolutely. And that is what makes immigrants great entrepreneurs, I think.
Now, let me ask you. So you have a lucky streak of 5 years where you were forced to work. I'm not forced, but you were in a position to work with the startups, which got you a head start into working at a startup, right? What are some other ways? So I hear all people saying that I want to eventually work for a startup, but I don't know how to get involved. What are some other ways? apart from consulting for startups that you can get involved?
There is no way. The only way to work at a startup is to work at a startup, meaning anyone who wants to work at a startup can work at a startup. Look, good startups are always looking for good people.
Okay.
They will never, if you are a smart person who would be a cultural fit and add value to the team,
mm-hmm.
startups will hire you.
Mm-hmm.
You may have to take a pay cut, which gets compensated in equity, all of that stuff aside. The point is, if you want to leave Microsoft and work at startup and you're cut for that, you
just
will
do it.
Have a job. And that's the only way to do it is take the plunge.
Got it.
The reason a lot of people say that they would want to work for a startup, but end up not doing it is because they get cold feet. Because it's uncomfortable. It's not as easy working at a startup.
Yeah.
Things change very fast. Expectations are very high. It's a brutal type of environment. It's chaotic.
Did you have some of those apprehensions?
No, I knew Osman from Chegg, right? So
okay.
I had seen Chegg grow from a relatively small company to tens of millions of dollars in revenue company. And I had been working with startups, so I kind of knew what I was getting into.
I see.
But then the other part of it is every startup is a different experience with its own nuances, which is the fun part. I think that's the fun of being at a startup versus being at a company which has been. So think about my first experience at ABB. This is a company that's 100 years old. They have operations in 120 countries. They have pretty much nailed everything down. So in that environment, when we think about internal consulting and let's make some difference by improving operations, we're talking marginal incremental improvements. Because if I can make a change which changes the top line by 2%, that is an award-winning type change.
Yeah.
At a startup, if you make a 2% change, nobody cares.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter, right? So, and therefore, your impact is much higher, your contribution is much higher, and if you're not able to deliver, you're not needed because mm-hmm. you're a burden on the team. So, yeah, so to your question, there were no apprehensions because I knew what I was getting into,
mm-hmm.
And you just have to be prepared to deal with chaos.
Yeah, so but Peter Thiel talks about it in 0 to 1, right, that you need to be exponentially better marginally as a startup, otherwise people won't adapt you.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that's absolutely true.
Yeah. So moving on. So what? How long did you work as a VP of finance?
Two and a half years.
I see.
And the last half year, I was moonlighting on the e-commerce company that I started after I left. And the work started while I was there. So for 6 months, that's the other part. When you're at a startup, you know that you don't quit your job to start a company before you get that company to a certain stage. And for me, that stage was I needed to get at least 3 paying customers before I would quit my job, which was, in all honesty, a well-paying job.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't, till that time, I didn't think too much about what's going to happen to my visa and all that stuff because
visa were you on when you were doing all this?
H-1B. I'm still on H-1B.
Oh, you're still on H-1B.
Yeah.
I see. Okay.
So, I didn't think too much about what's going to happen to my visa and stuff because I've always been a believer. Let's do what we can and we'll cross the bridge when we get there.
Got it.
You obviously plan for certain things ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
And my plan was if the business is working, I'm sure there will be a way that we can find. And so in 6 months, we got to a point where we were able to get users to use the product. In its basic
shape. So what was the product? What is the company? Can you explain a bit more?
Very simply, it would be Zappos for cosmetics. What we were trying to solve for is, I don't know how much you know about the cosmetics world. You and I should not know too much. But 97% of cosmetic sales are in physical stores. So clearly, with the growth of e-commerce, cosmetics hasn't caught up. And as we looked into why, we figured that this is an industry which is driven primarily by the physical experience of the product. So I spent a good amount of time researching the buying behavior of cosmetic buyers. And when you look at it, if when someone's buying a cream, the actual advantage of the cream, which is, let's say it's a hydrating cream, the hydration part is ignored. What's more important is how it smells and how it feels on the skin. Because if either of those two are uncomfortable, you're not going to buy that. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, same thing with shampoo or think of aftershave or any of those things, right? You, when you go to the store, the first thing you do with a shampoo bottle is you smell
it. Yeah.
You don't try it on there. Mm-hmm. Right. And those experiences, it's very difficult to buy a product that you don't know online. The other big consideration is 90%+ of cosmetics are bought by women. And women like change. There's always new products coming to the market, mm-hmm. and the shoppers' needs change over time. You know, it's not that our basic skin conditions change, but the surroundings change, and as we grow, different needs emerge. So there's this constant discovery process involved, and which makes them buy new products every year to year and a half. So
the problem you explained is that there is actually a physical limitation to moving cosmetics online because of the smell and everything.
There's no physical limitation. The challenge is that if you're buying clothes, for example, you order clothes, they show up at your home, you try them. If they don't fit, you send them back, right? There's no problem with that. Kind of what Zappos did with shoes. Mm-hmm. If your shoes don't fit, the reason people weren't buying shoes before Zappos online was because I'm always worried if they don't fit, I have to now pay shipping to send them back. Zappos took that pain away, right? And when you're shopping for cosmetics, the fear is the same. What if it smells bad? What if it doesn't feel good on my hair, etc.? What am I going to do? So we took that fear away by providing on 100% of our products, we were providing free trials. So it wasn't a subscription. It's not like the box companies. It was just plain and simple. You're shopping. You like some. You think you like something. There's a try button and a buy button. If you want to try, just click try. About 70% of our products had samples, so we would ship samples to the users. And those who didn't have the products that didn't have samples, we would ship a full size product without charging the user anything. For samples, obviously they try the sample. They know if they like it or not. They come back and buy or not. For full-size products, they have 15 days to try. And if they don't like it, they ship it back. If they like it, they keep it. And we charge the card on the 16th day. So this process took that fear of, if I don't like it, I'm stuck with the product away. Because with cosmetics, unlike clothing, for instance, you can't ship an open bottle back. You don't get returns for it, mm-hmm. right? So this ideology was working very, very well. Our secret sauce was data science. We were able to predict what user, what shopper would like which product the best. There were a lot of elements of data science involved, which was the work of my third co-founder, who was also an H1B holder.
I see.
So this is where things start converging into how Unshackled was born.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when I wanted to jump in full time, so just to kind of wrap up on all this simple stuff, mm-hmm. all of the samples and products that we were using for trials were provided by brands. So brands were not only paying us to host their products, but they were also paying us in the form of free product to run trials. We weren't paying for anything in that. To be able to convince brands to do that, before we even had a website and before we had hundreds of thousands of users, was my test. Is, can I convince a customer who would potentially benefit from this to sign up to do all this? And when that happened is when I wanted to quit, which led to, oh shit, I'm on an H1B.
So after you quit, the Trimble went on.
Trimble continued.
I see.
But my quitting was a part of that because it was three of us, three founders, two H1B holders, one citizen. And so the day we got our third customer, we were like, okay, all three need to jump in full time. This is a go. this thing, this business has legs. And that was when my second co-founder, who was at that time working at Macy, she was able to quit her job immediately. She has nothing to worry about. Here's my 2 weeks notice. And 2 weeks later, I'm going to be working full time on the startup. For me and the third co-founder, we had to figure out how we're going to be able to do it. Because if we do, we got to leave the country. I am married. This third co-founder was single. My wife at that time wasn't working. So we were all on my visa, right? Even though my wife previously had an H-1B. So that was kind of the starting point of, okay, how do we know?
So if you quit, you had to leave the country, basically.
Yeah.
Before you would come back in.
You're on H-1B. If you're not working, you're not needed here, right? You're as a worker.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, the solution came in about a month because, you know, my wife and I were talking and she said, okay, if I take the job, you can go on an H-4 visa, quit the job and continue to build this company until you raise money. And then the company can hire you. Like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So 3 months later, I was able to quit the job and dedicate my, I won't say join my startup because legally can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I was able to dedicate my time to building this company. My third co-founder, who was single and was the key data guy who was enabling all of this secret sauce that we were running, couldn't do it till March 31st of last year, which was our cutoff point. So a year and 3 months in, the business is doing really, really well. Our conversion rates are off the roof. Brands love us. Users love us. But we are ourselves throttling our growth because our data part can't keep up. And that's because my data scientist and data engineer is working only nights and weekends because he got to keep a day job. So that is when, you know, March 31st was our cutoff. There's another cycle that goes on there, which is when you're raising money with venture capitalists, they get excited about these things. And then they ask, okay, are you all full time? Are you all fully committed? If any of the co-founders is not, they're tuned out at that point. Why would they risk their money when you haven't risked your time yet?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And so, another CEO told me on one of the interviews that VCs don't have respect for people who wing it on the side, kind of, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, now I'm on the other side and I can respect that. I'm not saying I'm a VC, but, you know, almost all of our founders who joined in Shackled have jobs when they joined in Shackled, but I can respect that because you look at it from their perspective, they're putting their money behind you. And if you're yourself not fully committed, how should they be confident that they should take this risk? So, so that was basically March 31st was our decision point, March 31st, 2014, when we said, it's not going to work like this. I don't want to run a lifestyle business. This is either a startup which grows fast or I'm doing something else. So we all decided that's it. We moved on. April 1st. So going through that year and a half of frameworking on how we make this work led to what happened on April 1st last year, which was us, Manan, my now co-founder, and me deciding we're doing this. And it's very interesting here to hear Manan's side of the story because he's a citizen. He was born here in Saratoga, right in the middle of Silicon Valley, never had to think of visas. The only context in which he heard the word visa was Visa or MasterCard, right? And 29 years later, he starts a company with an H-1B co-founder. And my company was going to be the first customer for his company. So Manan and I had worked together at No. So we knew each other. We stayed in touch. Our companies were working together. He met the same end on March 31st, or his company got to the same point, and we were like, this is terrible. There's a much bigger problem here, and this is not just an immigrant's problem, this is an American problem.
Yeah.
And America is missing out on a lot of innovation that could happen. Entrepreneurs are missing out on a basic right, which is the right to make a choice. the choice to work and do what you would want to do. Obviously, within the confines of the law, you don't want to create a company that goes out and kills people, right? So, but all of us who are here are doing things that would make the world a better place.
Yeah.
So that's how Unshackled was born, because the framework of combining capital and employment, which could enable innovation by entrepreneurs who are on visas, was born through our personal journeys.
Yeah. So it's a very innovative solution that you came up with, right, as a part of Unshackled. So how was it like in the beginning days? I'm guessing there was a lot of excitement around the idea as such.
Well, we were obviously excited about the possibility. It was born out of desperation because, yeah, you know, we both looked at our respective situations and we said, we're just surprised nobody's done this yet. So there must be some problem with this system, with this model. So we spent 6 weeks working with a lot of attorneys, immigration, employment, corporate law, tax, IP, making sure we haven't left something of a landmine untouched. And obviously our backgrounds helped, because if we had to pay for all that legal fee, we would be bankrupt. But fortunately, we had built a lot of good relationships with attorneys, and that helped us get to a legal framework which was well validated, not just with law firms, but also validated with people in DC, the policymakers, including an ex-FCC chairman who knows immigration law very well.
Yeah. And so actually, I just realized we didn't talk about the methodology itself. Do you want to spend a minute saying how it works?
Yeah, we'll get to that very quickly. And so through this validation, what we wanted to be sure of was that we're not doing anything that breaks or bends the law, right? So staying within the framework of law, we had to create a solution that works for everybody. And that solution is simply providing capital alongside employment. If you look at the traditional venture investing world, all the way from early stage angel capital to growth capital, it comes in the same structure. There's an investor who cuts a check, there's a company who receives that money and issues equity in return. It's hard to believe that the needs for the needs of these companies from the earliest stages to growth stages are the same, right? And so what we looked at is, in the earliest days, what are the biggest challenges for companies? And specifically, when you look at teams with any one or more founders who are on visas, the biggest problem is when you're raising 200K, your company is not funded enough where CIS will feel comfortable granting the company the permission to hire visa holding employees. And the nuance of the law there is that if you're on a employer sponsored visa, like an H-1B or a TN, the company needs to demonstrate that it has the capability to pay you prevailing wages. The law is actually created to protect immigrants from abuse, because if the company doesn't have the capability, they'll now start exploiting you.
Yeah.
Right. So, but it starts working against you when you're trying to be entrepreneurial. So what we did is combine employment and capital. And what that really means is we invest the same amount and take the same kind of equity as angel investors do. Most of our investments are between 125K and 185K per team, which we don't send the money to the company. We keep the money aside as an R&D budget for that particular company and hire the team to perform R&D, because that's what startups do, right? Mm-hmm. So let's say it's, you know, two or three founders, some of who are visa holders, some might be citizens or permanent residents. Once we invest, the whole team is hired as employees of Unshackled. They are tasked with performing this product development to take this product to a stage where it is seed fundable.
I see. So, but they still own the company,
yeah,
and stuff?
Exactly. They do. Okay. And whether you are on a visa or a citizen or a permanent resident, you are fully in your rights to own stock in a company or in your rights to be on the board of directors of a company.
No, but this is not a company, right? This is Unshackled, like the team of five people, let's say, who are working in this product, are Unshackled employees.
There's both. So what happens is, let's just take an example. Let's say you, Rohit, and Andrew choose to start a company.
Mm-hmm.
You will incorporate that company. You will own stock in that company. And when Unshackled, let's say, agrees that, yes, this is an interesting product and will support you, we will also become a co-founder in the company.
Okay.
We'll take our equity stake alongside you guys. At that point, we'll hire you and anybody else who's needed to take this product to the next stage as Unshackled employees.
Okay.
Right? Because your job is to now take this product further.
Mm-hmm.
And our interest in doing that is, we have made an investment. We want the value of the company to grow. So it's totally our prejudice. It's not required by any contracts. It's what's called discretionary R&D.
Yeah.
To help grow this product. So that's how it's structured.
So in this way, you succeed only when I succeed.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, got it.
If you make $1 billion, we'll make a small portion of that as well. Right.
The question I had was, how do I prevent, I protect my ownership of the company if I am hired by you and the product comes as a part of your company?
It doesn't, right? So Unshackled is only helping develop the product as an R&D arm.
R&D arm. Okay,
own the product.
Mm-hmm.
Through an R&D agreement, the product is actually owned by your startup. So you and Andrew, the company that you started, let's call it
Breaking the Borders Inc.
That company is the one that owns the IP at all times.
Got it.
We don't sit on IP because that's not the nature of our business. We are a tech lab. We do R&D, which belongs to somebody else. Our employees perform R&D work, which belongs to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so at all times, you are building here the product sitting at Breaking the Borders Inc. Now, as you raise seed round, that's the purpose of that seed round, or whatever you raise next, is to help grow this product. So this company, Breaking the Borders Inc., will receive that capital, and now you will join that company as the executives to grow that company.
Got it. So you notice that in the starting phases, apart from funding, there is more that a startup needs, which is employee authorization. And that's why you, along with giving the funding, you're also giving employment to these people, right? So apart from these two, is there other things that you provide as well to your employees or to the startup owners?
Great question. So what we looked at is, you know, bringing people in and solving that one problem of how do I start my company is the starting point. Ultimately, the success for both the founders and therefore for us is as this company grows. So what we have to look at is, what do these founders need to get to the next stages of their journey? A big component of that is the network. A network of really smart people who are compassionate about the immigrants and who are passionate about innovation, which is a great intersection of innovation and immigration. So think of what we kind of realized from our experiences, for example, is as an immigrant, it took me for 7 years when I was in a job, It took a lot of effort to build a network. And even then, I didn't have the kind of network that I would have had if I went to school here.
Yeah.
Example. And, you know, that's just the reality. When you grow in an ecosystem, you just have a bigger network.
Yeah.
Which most immigrant founders don't. So the next big component to address is the network. And then finally, that network also brings, a good amount of knowledge share. Which, as you're building a startup, there's a lot of mistakes you're going to make. There's a lot of questions you're going to have. But if you're surrounded with smart people, they'll help you figure it out. You have to be extremely smart and receptive to the knowledge that's coming your way. But we often say this internally, that the biggest difference between successful companies and not so successful companies is the people they're surrounded by. It makes all the difference. And so the second thing we did as we went on the journey of raising capital is we strategically thought about who we should raise this capital from to provide an unfair advantage to our founders. And that is why if you look at our investor list, it's 80 plus people who are active at the seed stage. Mm-hmm. They're micro VCs, VCs, angel investors, aren't successful entrepreneurs themselves, big company executives who are in roles which require them to build a relationship with early stage companies, and that works, you know, that helps them be more successful in their jobs, mm-hmm. and helps startups build relationships with larger companies as channels. So the group that came together to support us is, you know, obviously we didn't imagine that we'll be able to bring all these people together, but there's some really influential people on this list. And the part that is humbling the most is how involved they are and how open they are in helping us and helping our portfolio companies.
Yeah. So how are they coming, or why are they coming to you? So they trust your ability to weed out or to, you know, screen through the applicants and only go for the best. Is that what it is?
I think it's multiple layers. It would be a great conversation for you to have with one of those investors.
Yeah.
To get their perspective. But, you know, from what we've heard, it's one of many things. I think there are people like, for example, Brad Feld or Steve Case, or Jeff Buzgang, who have been, Josh Kopelman, who have been working on the immigration reform for a long time. And, you know, they've met partial success, I would say, or their efforts for obvious reason. It's not to say they didn't put enough effort, right? Everybody's been trying really, really hard. But they're extremely familiar with the landscape. They understand the problem. And the moment they heard the solution, the light bulb went on, which is, okay, great, right? This solution doesn't need a policy change. It's an immediate solution. It makes all kind of sense. So, you know, for them, the conviction was, you're doing something right. You're doing something that we believe in, and we want to be a part of it.
Yeah.
I think that sentiment is quite prevalent throughout our investor group. Other pieces or other similarities across would be just the spirit of supporting innovation. There's enough being written, particularly by institutions like Kauffman Foundation, around how successful immigrant entrepreneurs have been and how much they've contributed to the American economy. So for those who are not intimately familiar with immigrants and the challenges, for them, it's pretty simple to understand that some of the most successful companies have been founded by immigrants. And if this solution can unlock an untapped pool of entrepreneurs and give them the opportunity to do things that they want to do, this could be a very meaningful investment.
Yeah.
And then I think, you know, a part of it is these are people who have funds who they want to deploy behind smart companies. So yeah. if we can help bring in a new flow of smart entrepreneurs, we're feeding them opportunities to invest behind us.
Sure.
All in all, it's a great combination of doing good and doing well. I think that's the sentiment that resonates the most across all of our investors.
Yeah. Sure. So you have been doing this for a while, right? More than a year now.
Yeah.
Are there any companies that went through your fund and been successful that you can share about?
So we have been at it for over a year, but the very first companies that we started in March. So it's not been
March of this year.
March of this year.
Oh, okay.
Because, you know, we had to go through our own startup journey, which is build the MVP, raise money behind it, and then start the building the product and such. So the timelines have been, we raised the fund through last summer, announced it in November, and then started looking at teams that were applying. So we were overwhelmed with applications in the December, January timeframe.
How did you get them? How did you get applications?
Multiple ways. It's a combination of the networking. So network of our investors, what we call the friends of the fund, who are not our investors, but are active in the investing landscape. We do a lot of work with universities and ethnic communities. Things like these, what we're doing right now.
Yeah.
A lot of this leads to creating awareness, which drives entrepreneurs to us. So they come to us either referred by someone we know, or they find us on one of the articles or
yeah, since you mentioned, if someone listening wants to apply, what is the best way to do it?
Just go to our website, unshackled.co. There's an application form there. It's great if you can find someone who knows us in common who can introduce us so you rise above the noise. But if not, we do expect, like I said, that not all immigrant entrepreneurs have the networks. So we do expect that direct applications will come in. But it always helps if you have someone in common, helps break the ice better.
Got it. What is the best way for someone who doesn't know you, who is just putting an application, to raise above the noise, who don't have anyone in common? Like, what stands out for you?
The application itself, I'm guessing you haven't seen it, but if you take a look, the application itself is intended to make you write things which will make it stand out if you are stand out. So we don't have any metrics on the application. It's primarily to understand the team and what you are going after. If you're solving a meaningful problem, if the solution is reasonably meaningful, which we understand the solution is going to change a few times before it actually becomes something. But I would say 80% of our focus is on the team and its relevance to the space you are in. The other 20% is, are you doing something that could be venture fundable, meaning you're working in a large market, a growing market, and it's not oversaturated and all that good stuff. But, you know, we look at the right team as our biggest inspiration. So the application, as it goes through our initial cycles of review, those that are smart founders rises above.
Got it. Yeah, I'm going through the application now. You have a lot of questions over there, right? You have an opportunity to put all your team in a video. What is the idea? All the links, your website. So yeah, you're asking for a lot of information. I mean, I understand what you mean when you say if you go through the application, you'll understand.
Yeah, and look, we're both Manan and I, we're very reachable. We're often out in the community. We do a number of events, and when we do events, we're very reachable. So
we take
personal pride in engaging with entrepreneurs. Sometimes even before they have an idea.
Yeah,
we just started an EIR program specifically for immigrants. Because we realize that a lot of times you're really good at what you do and you work really hard at the job at which you are, which means you don't have enough time to go out and build a team, do all the market research that you need to do
to
get to a point where we would be looking at it as an investment opportunity. So for those individuals, we started the EIR program, and the first cohort is starting later this month. And we'll continue to, you know, we'll continue to work on a number of such initiatives which help us serve the entrepreneurial community better.
Yeah. So what is the best way to reach you if someone wants to connect with you?
Apply through the website.
Apply through the website. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Follow us on Twitter. We often, anytime we were hosting events, we talk about it through our Twitter feed. There's a newsletter that you can subscribe to. Which
what is the Twitter handle?
Unshackled US.
Okay.
You can also subscribe to the newsletter at the bottom of our website, which is also a great means to get to know what's going on.
Sure. Yeah, I will leave all the links to everything that Nitin mentioned in the show notes. Is there anything else, Nitin, that you'd like to mention?
Well, I think, you know, you mentioned in the beginning the personal experiences transcend into to meaningful solutions. And I think that's a big component, which also links back to when we look at applications, for instance, now we see that solutions born out of personal experiences are often much more powerful and much more practical than ideas that came up because I was looking to do something entrepreneurial. And
that is more in lines of like solving a pain versus, coming up with an idea. It's like a vitamin tablet versus painkiller, some people say, right?
Yeah. Or alternatively, way to look at it is, are you creating a solution for a need that exists, or are you creating a need for a solution that you just dreamt up? Right. So which is both okay, because if nobody had thought of a need of touch devices, we would not have touch devices today, because there was no pain point in pressing buttons. But someone thought that I should create a touch device which will make life much better, which is it's okay to create a need from a solution. But most of the times, on this topic about using personal experiences, solutions born out of personal experiences are often very powerful, very practical. The team is usually much more passionate about those solutions and therefore doesn't waver that easily. To me, it's about, as an entrepreneur, or most entrepreneurs often look for solutions when they see problems. They look for an opportunity to do something better when they see a problem. And that's a common trait across all entrepreneurs. So to me it's mostly about, let's not get bogged down by adverse experiences in our lives. Everybody goes through them. Very few people can think of solving the problem that led to that adverse situation. Even lesser have the capability to take action on them. Mm-hmm. And those who have that capability and then the willingness and drive to go through a very painful entrepreneurial journey to solve often come out on the bright side. So it's very, to me, inspirational as I meet a lot of other entrepreneurs who are doing things that they saw either through their personal life experiences or in their working lives. Mm-hmm. Someone who's working in networking, for example, saw what is wrong with networks the way we see them and saw an opportunity to make experiences better. Mm-hmm. You think of today's life that we have.
Can you give a real example from any of your...
Exactly where I was going.
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
What we are doing right now, this conversation is possible because there's a network that exists. An invisible network has been created. We continue to use more and more of it to communicate, to stream videos, to play games, browse content and whatnot. But what would make this experience better? If I want to play high intensity games, or if I want to stream high density videos, can I do that when my bandwidth isn't as powerful? Fortunately, you and I are in locations where we have great bandwidths, but that's mm-hmm. not the case everywhere. So we recently engaged with this company, GridRaster, which the founding team comes from traditional networking companies, and they saw this opportunity that very quickly the use of networks is growing phenomenally. And another big trend is most households now have multiple devices with connectors, meaning network connectors, and computing power.
Yeah.
So what can we do to use these redundant devices or the redundant capacity on these devices to make network usage better? And they're coming up with a product which would make it much better user experience using this redundant capacity and reduce the load on networks.
What is the company again?
GridRaster.
Okay.
So there's a lot of these things that we see. Similarly, another company, the very first one we funded, both guys with search backgrounds, they're both search engineers, and they're creating a search engine for e-commerce websites, which is by far the best search that I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, their first pilot is now live on TalkSpot.com, which if anybody wants to look at it, it's phenomenal. You basically type out your intent and products just show up. So I think this, you know, personal experiences don't necessarily just mean personal life experiences. They could also be your professional experiences.
Yeah.
But the other side of this is, for example, with my first company, what I was doing was I was playing out of my wheelhouse. I had no experience with e-commerce, or except, you know, to the extent some of my clients at Deloitte were e-commerce companies. But when it comes to cosmetics e-commerce, I knew nothing. My co-founder had retail experience at Macy's, Williams-Sonoma, etc. And so I would say in that situation, it was a stretch for the team, because even though we saw an opportunity to do something great and we were doing great, we were, I would say, not as passionate about it as we would be if it had been a personal problem for me. For example, the way I'm passionate about Unshackled,
yeah.
I don't know if I was about Trimble. It's hindsight now, and I can't comment. I still gave it my 100%. So
got it.
That's where I say that you know, these adverse experiences are not always adverse if you can learn from it and create a solution which helps not just you but millions of people who may be facing the same or similar problem. Mm-hmm.
So that's how I started talking to other immigrant entrepreneurs as well. So I was a fan of podcasts and interviews in general, and I used to go through hours and hours of them in my car, in my walks, and wherever. And whenever I heard people from other parts of the world in my favorite shows like Mixergy and Entrepreneur on Fire, I felt instantly connected. So I found myself digging through their archives to find these entrepreneurs. And then I figured I ran out of them eventually. Then I figured I could do this myself, you know, talk to other immigrant entrepreneurs like I'm doing right now.
Yeah, and that's great. I think what you're doing is great. Every story has some inspiration for others. Happy to continue this. Happy to introduce you to some of our portfolio company founders who, by definition, there's at least one immigrant entrepreneur on every team.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'll reach out to some of them. Is all your portfolio up on your website? Is out for the public, or there are some things that are not?
There's a couple deals we just closed last week,
okay.
So they're not on there yet, but they will be next
okay.
week. I'm happy to put you in touch over email with them.
Absolutely.
To continue the progression, you should come by some of our events and
absolutely. I'll sign up your newsletter. I'm guessing that's how you keep everyone posted about your event, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I will. And any book or a resource that you can recommend for people who are interested in startups and entrepreneurship?
If I recommend any one, that would be unfair to others that I won't recommend. So
okay.
I won't do that. I feel like there's a great amount of resources now available. And as you said, you connected well with podcasts. And so, you know, podcast was your way. Some people like reading books, some people like reading blogs, others are much more comfortable in a talk. A personal connection type scenario. So,
what's yours? I'm curious. What is your way to learn new information?
Observing mostly. I observe a lot.
From experience, you're saying that.
Yeah. I find it very difficult to. I think it's just I can't do just one thing, and if mm-hmm. that one thing is a passive thing, which is listening to someone, I lose concentration pretty quickly.
Right.
Start working.
That's hard to get though. You are in a fortunate situation to be able to observe, right? But many may not be. So
yeah, but exactly, you're absolutely right.
It's
you have to find the situation as well. So sometimes the reason, for example, I took the job at No was because I wanted to observe a serial entrepreneur in action.
Yeah.
Right. So sometimes you create the opportunity yourself. Sometimes even though you try, you may not be able to. So I would say I'm blessed. I'm very fortunate that things have worked out for me the way they have. A lot of things could have shaped differently. And I may not be doing what I'm doing, but that's an if then else type of scenario, which we can't get into. It's too hypothetical. So I think to just wrap up on that answer, whichever is your favorite way, whichever method you connect with the most, there's enough resources today available that entrepreneurs should and can learn from. You know, I often actually, the other part that I do, it's my part of my daily morning routine is reading some of the blogs by other entrepreneurs and some of the VCs I respect. So I have my daily Feedly feed that shows up in the morning. And
yeah, who is your favorite? Anyone you want to mention again? Yeah, you can't be unfair
to anyone, but you know, some of the more frequent bloggers obviously are Brad Feld, Mark Suster, Fred Wilson. But we live, you know, I feel so fortunate in the times we live in, because it's so easy for us now. All I have to do is, even if any of my bloggers I like writes once in 3 months, if they're in my Feedly feed, I'm going to see their blog. So I don't have to make that much effort anymore. And so, you know, my feed on Feedly includes a number of people who write on a variety of topics. So, yeah, I like to read from a lot of different perspectives, not just a VC's perspective, but it's very important for us to also have a good amount of entrepreneurs' perspective. So I read a bunch of blogs by entrepreneurs who are still in the grind.
So, choose your favorite medium, and there is ample content in that.
There's a ton of resources now available. To still keep it very efficient, because a part that I struggled mostly with is I can't dedicate more than 15 minutes in a day to this educational process. And for me, if I can go through my digest on a daily basis, digest of news and blogs in about 15 minutes, I feel much more informed.
Yeah, got it. Good. I think I asked most of the things I wanted to. Anything else you would like to mention before we wrap?
Nothing. I think it's, you know, what you're doing is great. I hope this inspires, if you've inspired two people to pursue their entrepreneurial journey, you've done your job.
Yeah, that's what kept me going, right? Like you don't get a lot of downloads, you don't get a lot of clicks in the beginning. And I told myself, even if there is one person who does things differently because of this, that's good enough.
That's it. Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, that's how we feel, is that we have made meaningful impact for anyone. We've done our part. The only thing as parting notes that I would say is, until we existed, we hear this often from entrepreneurs who now, for example, have green cards, and they were like, the day they got their green card, they quit their job and started their company. And they often tell us, oh, I wish you were around 4 years ago. So what we tell entrepreneurs of today is, you don't have to wish anymore.
Yeah.
There is a solution.
Absolutely.
Just pursue, do your part, do the hard work. And everything else will work out. There are solutions. There are people more than willing to help you if you're doing something meaningful.
Absolutely.
So reach out for help if you need. Engage with, I know people who are really, really busy, but if you write them, even if you write them a cold email, but it's something meaningful, they will respond and engage with you.
Great. Thank you very much for joining me today, Nitin.
All right, thank you.
Thank you for tuning in. To get updates on latest episodes, make sure you subscribe with your email by going over to breakingtheborders.com. If you know anyone good as a guest, shoot me an email. I will reach out to the guest, get hold of them, and ask them all the questions that you have. My email is rohit@breakingtheborders.com. Thanks again and have an amazing day.